Hello, and welcome to a very special edition of Open Source Sex. I'm Violet Blue. I am a sexuality author. I'm a sexuality lecturer. I'm the sex columnist for the San Francisco Chronicle. I was named a Forbes Web Celeb. This year I was named one of Wired's 2008 Faces of Innovation, among many other things. I also lecture at places like eTech and Google about sex and technology. And today's edition of Open Source Sex is actually an MP3 of a panel that I organized for South by Southwest Interactive about sexual privacy. It's the Sexual Privacy Online panel. And it was an amazing panel. It's a long podcast. I would say that this is probably about an hour long. And what it is it's a live panel debate and discussion and also audience participation about sexual privacy with me. I was the moderator and organizer. It also includes Zoe Margolis, who's writer and sex blogger, girl with a one-track mind, Jonathan Moore, who's a hacker and security expert, Jason Schultz, who's a policy fellow at the EFF, the Electronic Frontier Foundation, and also a cyber law professor at UC Berkeley, and John Daddario, who's an editor for Gawker Media, Fleshbot.com. And the question that we seek to answer on this panel is, can anyone really be sexually anonymous online? Being outed, thinking you're anonymous, trolls and stalkers taking advantage of online communities, porn laws resulting in performers being stalked, Google's history logs tracking all of us, and paying for adult goods and services online safely. Internet sexual privacy affects everyone and our rights. This panel brought together a spectrum of views on sexual privacy and identity, including a controversial sex blogger, a cyber law expert, and a hacker who works for a social networking site. We discussed and we demonstrated how easy it is to lose control of one's sexual identity online, and how to get it back or keep it intact in the first place. Because you don't have to be a sex blogger or answer the wrong Craigslist ad or order a vibrator online to have your sexual identity messed with. Sometimes all you need to be is female, queer, or just make a simple mistake when you hit the button for send. The consequences can be devastating. We explored what obstacles people face maintaining personal privacy, including bad or unsympathetic online community management, systems and social exploits like Craigslist baiting and outing, stalkers and trolls, the legal aspects of sexual privacy online and their application to individuals, and what we can all do to keep our sexual privacy private. And now, without further ado, I hope you enjoy our panel. My name is Violet Blue. Welcome to Sexual Privacy Online. This is a panel discussing a bunch of different aspects of sexual privacy online and all of its different permutations. I'll scoot a little closer to the mic here. And the thing, I guess one of the main points that I have to say about sexual privacy online is that it goes in a lot of different directions. But most of all, the internet just in general has changed our sexuality as a human species forever in ways that we just can't even comprehend yet, because it's allowed and afforded us a way to express ourselves online anonymously and not anonymously in ways that we've never had a chance to ever in life. So, for instance, let's talk about fetishes for just a second really quick here. A fetish is a really great example of something that someone might seek out online, but not in real life. And it's also a great example of the way that people can express themselves intentionally or unintentionally, have sexual expression or their sexual anonymity sort of jeopardized or questioned or called into question. For instance, this is the Flickr photo pool for Zentai, which is a fabulous fetish where people wrap themselves from head to toe in spandex. And it's a great example of intentional individual expression, but as you can tell, they're all pretty anonymous. So obviously, these people would stand to lose quite a lot, or some of these people would stand to lose quite a lot if their anonymity was jeopardized in one way or another. Jobs, friends, family, etc. But this is a healthy way and a healthy outlet and a means for them to express their feelings about their fetish. This is a great example of people unknowingly being assigned a sexual identity online. And it's an interesting fetish, isn't it? Seatbelt across the breast, purse straps also. Some of these people are, they may or may not know that their photos are in this pool. They may or may not feel okay about it. They may be proud. They may have asked to have their photos put in this pool. So it's pretty interesting when you think about it. So what I want to talk about too is our sexuality and the way that we're sexualized online calls into question our awareness of the outside world and how the outside world is looking at us and perceiving us, and also taking a look at who we are and how we express ourselves. And I think that if people knew how much their privacy was at risk, actually, when they were being sexual online or even when they're being non-sexual online, I think that
it would call into question how people proceeded about how they filled out that Facebook profile or that Pounce page or put that Nerve's personals ad up. On one hand, it's great that it's allowing us a new context to be able to define our sexuality in ways that we never have before. But on the other hand, it's putting people in situations and in places where they're putting personal information out into a public space and they may or may not be aware of it. One really good example of the way that this can be exploited was, oh, and by the way, I probably should have mentioned, there's going to be nudity in this presentation. There's going to be frank sexual discussion in this presentation. There are going to be expletives. You're not going to see any pornography or penetration. But if you're uncomfortable with frank sexual talk or images such as this, sorry to surprise you with that in a Zentai, but if you're uncomfortable with it, this is probably a really good time to exit. So this is the Craigslist experiment, and pardon me if you've heard this tale before, but about a year and a half ago, a man named Jason Fortuny performed what he called the Craigslist experiment, where he and a friend took a very extreme, hardcore, women-seeking men anonymous Craigslist ad and put it online to see how many responses they could get. And they got 176 responses that included pictures, home email addresses, phone numbers, people emailed from work, people left voicemails, people exposed themselves in a million different ways. He took all of that information and he published it on an online wiki called Encyclopedia Dramatica. He then went on his LiveJournal page, announced the Craigslist experiment, and said, so the goal here is to identify as many people as you know in real life as possible and give us as many personal details as you can. So basically, a lot of people that answered that ad probably had no idea what they were stepping into. And it's a good example of, yes, there are some people who are out to get you out there. It's also a really good example of people answering ads and not being aware of what information they're sending when they're answering ads, which is an aspect of privacy that people don't understand, that it's sort of a two-way street as well. Although I will put forth that some of the people that answered the ad from the Craigslist experiment probably totally were aware that they were answering an extreme ad, answered from an address that they didn't care about having compromised, didn't use their real names, didn't give a real phone number. So, you know, it's all about levels of awareness here. And what you're looking at here is the ad that they had, that they used, that they took from another city, and they reposted it in Craigslist Seattle. And this is on the right, actually, the image that we ran on Fleshbot when we posted about it on Fleshbot, where we took the photograph at the bottom, which was the image that accompanied the ad, and we put a little exclamation point over the access points for privacy, and put a sensor bar over one of the images of the actual respondents that responded to the Craigslist ad. And as an interesting side note about this, after this happened, well, first of all, there was a copycat in Portland shortly thereafter. There was also a recent copycat in Florida about 2 months ago. So this is sort of an ongoing thing of griefers sort of gaming, compromising people's sexual identity online for fun. So, you know, basically trolling for people who are just not aware, you know, people who will answer the Nigerian bank scammers, you know, and exposing them because, you know, obviously they think that sex is shameful. But interestingly enough, talking about this ad with a couple of other sex educators, looking at the language that was used, first of all, it's a really extreme ad. It's an ad for a woman basically seeking a rough male top to play out what is essentially a very rough, violent rape fantasy scenario. It's really clear to me and the other educators that I work with that whoever originally placed this ad was completely unaware of the usual safe, sane terminology that accompanies any type of BDSM play. And also this is an ad that's very typical of someone who may be playing with extreme types of transgender identity, which is another thing that is really interesting about all of this, is that that's another way that people can sort of play with their sexual identity online anonymously, is by placing an ad like this. So say someone may be questioning their gender identity. They place an ad like this to see what kind of responses they get. They get responses along the same lines that Jason Fortuny got, which essentially maybe validate their sexual identity or maybe not validate their sexual identity, but it allows people to play sort of anonymously with how they're expressing themselves, what type of response they get. And typically when someone does place an ad like this and they're experimenting with their transgender identity, it's not out of malfeasance, it's out of experimentation, and they generally don't respond to these ads. So there was also recently the case of, first of all, there was a police officer who was recently fired for having an adult website with his wife. He was a swinger and got fired from the police department for it. Another part of sexual anonymity that I hope we get to cover here, I'm going quickly, is I want to talk about how sexual identity and anonymity is policed in online communities, because I think that's a really important part of our social networking conversations. So for instance, every once in a while, my Flickr account gets called into question, and as to whether or not I am rating my photographs appropriately. I'm a high profile sex writer, sex blogger. So, you know, people will be like, there's a nipple in that photo, you know, and they'll flag me, and then I get caught up in Flickr system, and then I have to be like, okay, what is your policy? And Flickr's policy is really unclear. And then all of a sudden I have people at Flickr combing through photos that I have had private that I don't really feel comfortable with having these people come through these photos, because I put them up and I thought that they were private. And so that's another thing to think about as well. So I just have to add that. Probably true too. So really quickly also, don't do this. When I gave my sexual privacy online talk at Google, I was talking about 2257 laws, which are basically federal record-keeping requirements that pornographers as primary producers need to keep in order to put porn online that essentially verifies the age of the performers. They're very onerous. They're very they're very questionable. One of the ways in which they're questionable is that they have people like this woman who has her own website, her own porn website, and she's making her own porn website. She's doing it herself. And so one of the ways that she thinks that she needs to sort of follow these federal record keeping requirements is to provide her own type of documentation to prove that she is of age. And when I gave this talk at Google, I showed this slide and a couple of other slides where I just went on, you know, I found these online basically. And one guy in the audience raised his hand and was like, where did you find those? And I was like, Google image search. And he was like, how exactly did you find them? And I said, well, first you turn safe search off. And then you Google for 2257 documentation or something along those lines. I explained to him exactly how I found these images. And I got an email back a couple days later saying that they had gone through and wiped all these images from their database, and that was now part of their policy, was to go through and start looking for examples of people trying to do their own DIY federal record keeping requirement documentation, because it puts performers at such risk. So, and, you know, as someone who wants, you know, as this person is a sex worker, you know, in order for her to comply with the law, she's being put into a position that compromises her safety and her security and her privacy in order to keep her safe. So who needs sexual privacy the most besides bloggers, porn performers, and people answering Craigslist ads? People considered sexual minorities, lesbians, gays, bisexual, and transgender people, those identified by their sexual orientation and gender identity, regardless of their interest in the act of sex. In most places, LGBT and questioning people faced hostility from within as well as the outside world. We all know about the case of Matthew Shepard in Wyoming, who found out in 1998 that being gay in Wyoming was a death sentence. Somewhat more recently, brutal transgender murders like Brandon Tina, movie Boys Don't Cry, still happen, as in with the 2002 murder of 17-year-old Gwen Arujo from Newark, California. But I think that now with a quick Google search, people can find online community anonymously and in privacy, which I think are really, really key and important factors in order for them to find community that they can network with. And not, you know, when they're facing hostility in the real world, they can find community online and not have to face risk, which is a lot of what we're talking about here. And this is the Sexual Minority Youth Resource Center. And I really like this picture because it says, Smirk saved my life. And it's a really cool resource. So what I'm going to do now is I'm going to ask people down the panel to introduce themselves and talk about why they are here. So Jonathan Moore.
So I'm Jonathan Moore. I'm here because I have built and work with social networks ranging from thousands of users to millions and millions of users. And I've spent a lot of time thinking about the privacy and security of these sites, breaking them. Most of the major social networking sites do or have had serious security flaws. And I also know a good bit about other kinds of security and email and that kind of stuff. So I'm sort of here to help give guidance of so what's technically possible and in terms of violating and securing privacy.
Thank you.
My name is John Daddario. I'm the editor of Fleshbot.com. And I guess I'm here because a big part of our stock and trade is investigating and posting about instances of sexual privacy either being maintained or violated. It's something that I come across every day in the work that I do for the site. And we'll talk more about that once we go down the line.
Definitely.
Thank you very much for the nice piece you did on me. Sure. My name is Zoe Margolis. I'm the blogger and author of Girl with a One-Track Mind, which is or was mostly a blog detailing the ins and outs of my sex life, which I wrote very honestly and explicitly because I was anonymous when I wrote it. And
Zoe, I have a slide up of your outed post, by the way.
Oh, well, there you go.
Yeah.
So, yes, as you can see, 3 days after my book came out, a newspaper in England decided to out me. And I dealt with the repercussions of that. And I'm here today, and it's very surreal sitting in front of a group of people saying, hi, I shagged around and wrote about it and being very sort of nervous. So anyway, it's very weird being here.
My name is Jason Schultz. I'm a fellow at the Electronic Frontier Foundation and a faculty member at UC Berkeley School of Law, where I teach about internet law and free speech and privacy. And I'm here actually to talk a little bit about how the law handles these kinds of issues in the United States is where I'm going to focus about, do you have legal recourse and against whom if information about your sex life or what you're interested in sexually does get exposed, or how you can protect yourself legally, if at all? You want me to?
I would love it if you.
Okay, so I prepared just a few slides. I don't know if we can switch over to that.
Yep.
That'd be great. Just to kind of give some background. They're all going to freak you out with these stories, and that's good. And then I'm going to show you how the law does and does not help you. Okay, so I'm going to talk about five different kinds of rights, privacy rights, that the law in the United States gives you. There are a lot more than this, actually, in terms of statutory rights and special laws and things. But I wanted to focus on these five because these are the ones that are, in theory, the most helpful. And I also want to highlight that the first four of these are rights that you have against the government, constitutional rights to keep them from getting information on you and various things. And the last one is really against everyone else. And I want that to be kind of the theme here, which is that the way the law has been built up is that we've been most afraid of the government invading our privacy, exposing us, doing things to us, and that maybe we have to start thinking about the fact that, you know, various user-generated content crowdsourcing movements might pose other privacy threats. Not that we necessarily have to do anything about that, but that it's something to think about if we want to. So the first one is that you do have a sort of right of privacy to sexual activity. And this comes from the 14th Amendment and the 5th Amendment of the U.S. Constitution. It's sort of a due process right, which sort of comes from the idea of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. And in order to do that, you have to have some freedom. So the first main case on this was actually this 1965 case about birth control and contraception. There was a law outlawing doctors from prescribing and counseling married couples, heterosexual couples, on birth control options. And they challenged that law. And the court said that, yeah, that was unconstitutional because you have a right to determine as a married couple what kind of sexual activities you want to do in terms of reproduction. That ruling then got extended in the famous case of Roe v. Wade in 1973 to the idea that not only do you get to get counseling and birth control, but actually you can decide when you're pregnant as a woman what rights you have to your body, what choices you want to make up until a certain point of viability of the fetus. But again, it was this notion of that you have a liberty in yourself and your body and your choices, especially in something as intimate as sexual activity. And then most recently in 2003, many people saw this. There was the case of Lawrence v. Texas, which is about the right to have sort of consensual sexual activity in your home. This was a Texas law that outlawed sodomy. They arrested two people who were engaging in the activity in the privacy of their own home. They challenged that law. And the court finally overturned an old precedent that had said it was okay and said, no, if you're doing this kind of sexual activity in the privacy of your own home, it is a right of privacy that you have, and the government cannot put you in jail for doing it. So that's one sort of right you have against the government. The second set of rights are free speech and association, and these kind of come from the First Amendment. And the idea is that if you don't have some right of privacy or anonymity, your free speech might get chilled. In other words, you might be hesitant to speak or associate or go around publicly or be parts of groups if you can get prosecuted for it. So the more able you are to be private or anonymous when you publish or speak, the more you might actually speak your mind. And there are a couple of three cases here. Again, I can't go into too many details given the time, but the first one, the Watchtower Bible case, is actually interesting because it involves Jehovah's Witnesses going door to door in the town of Stratton, the village actually of Stratton. And the town had passed an ordinance saying they had to register their name, address, affiliation before they went door to door. And the court actually struck that down, saying, no, actually, the right to speak, you have a right to speak anonymously unless there's a reason why you shouldn't. So the court actually found that as part of the First Amendment that you didn't have to identify yourself by name if you wanted to publish or go talk to someone unless you were a known criminal who was going to defraud them or something where there's already evidence against you. The second case, Doe v. Cahill, is about legal subpoenas. And this is actually a huge area. This is how a lot of information gets disclosed about people. Companies like Google or Yahoo or other places will get legal subpoenas saying, tell me who this person is. And actually, there's been a bunch of good case law, a bunch of good court decisions saying that actually, no, if you're anonymous online, you have a legal right to stay that way. And a court should not disclose who you are unless the person asking has already proven that you violated the law. Essentially, you have to already show, if I want to find out who you are anonymously, I have to go to court and say, look, here's all the proof. I don't know who they are, but here's how they violated all the rights. And you have to have evidence to show that before a court discloses the identity of the person. Finally, NAACP versus Alabama. This is about a right of association. This was a case where law enforcement wanted the NAACP to turn over the list of all their members. And again, here the Supreme Court said, no, in fact, that would chill their participation in political action. So there is, even as we talk about social networks and things like that, these cases haven't been applied to the internet, but there's some foundations here for saying even the way you associate on certain controversial subjects could be protected by the First Amendment, because if anyone could out you as to who you were, maybe you wouldn't participate. The third thing I want to talk about is the right to read or search anonymously. There's a lot of modern case law on this, but I think it's an interesting couple of cases. The main one I want to talk about is Sweezy versus New Hampshire. And this was a case in which they wanted to find out what research certain academics have been doing and other information about kind of what people have been reading. And the Supreme Court said, no, again, you have a right under the First Amendment to kind of read or search for resources anonymously. And if you don't have it, that then there'll be a chilling effect. And the court said that, you know, for society's good, if understanding it be an essential need of society, that inquiries into intellectual problems, speculations about them, stimulation in others of reflection upon them must be left as unfettered as possible. So again, the Supreme Court of the United States is sort of saying, if you want to have these kind of social interactions, anonymity actually might be a really good thing for society. Again, this is an old case, not applying it to the internet, but there's sort of legal foundations here. And again, this was a government action trying to find out what people were doing. Finally, under the Fourth and Fifth Amendment, there are some very specific information privacy protections. The Fourth Amendment is mostly about unlawful search and seizures. So and the main cases that started this kind of trend were dealing with wiretapping, listening in on communications. In the famous Katz case of 1967, where the government actually, it was held that it couldn't wiretap people in theory. I don't know under the current administration whether that's still true, but without a warrant. And one interesting note I want to make here is that in 1979, though, there was a case, Smith v. Maryland, where the government didn't want to wiretap the people, but they wanted to get their phone records, who they'd been calling and when. And the Supreme Court actually said that, no, that's actually a little different. When it's your conversation or you own the information, you have a Fourth Amendment right that protects you. But when a third party has that information, you don't have a Fourth Amendment right that protects you. In other words, if you've given that information voluntarily to a company, they can actually disclose it to the government and it's not a violation.
Would that also be included in something like terms of use?
Yeah. So this is exactly where this comes in. So to the extent that people are relying on third party providers.
Okay.
Yeah. Any kind of website or blogging service or Facebook or any of those things. This is exactly where that issue comes in. I just want to point out there is actually a Fifth Amendment right to privacy and information, and it stops the government from getting some of your sexual history, medical records, financial information. But again, this is only against the government when they're doing inquiries into your background. And then finally, and this is the point I'll end on, this is the one sort of set of rights that you have against other individuals, not against the government. And it's there are lots of state laws, and they're generally called the right to be left alone. They, public disclosure of embarrassing facts, you know, intrusion into seclusion for celebrities and these kind of things. And then I want to focus on this one case real quick, Sipple versus Chronicle. This is a case involving a guy who, when there was an assassination attempt on President Ford, and I think it was the late 70s. And this guy, he's actually on the left. That's Oliver Sipple there, who's kind of rushing in there. This is a photo of him sort of tackling the shooter. And so the San Francisco Chronicle did an expose on him. Well, it turns out that he's not only an ex-Marine, but he was a homosexual as well, or at least that's what the article claimed. And so when they published that, it was something that most people didn't know about him. And for obvious reasons, he might have been a little hesitant to disclose that information. So he sued the Chronicle saying, hey, you disclosed this really personal, embarrassing information about me. And the court said, well, it's not the government. It's a private newspaper. They're not held to the same standards. And in fact, it's newsworthy. People want to know about you, who you were. And therefore, it's protected by the First Amendment. So you often get these conflicts between privacy and the First Amendment. So I just want to kind of end. We can talk more about that and how it affects everything. But these are some open questions that are left about people who put sexual information online or search for sexual information online. There's a good question about who owns that information. When are you private versus public? Because that's a big thing the law cares about, is whether something's private or public. When are you newsworthy? Which is, I think, very interesting question, given that, you know, what does it mean if you have 1,000 people reading your blog? Are you then newsworthy? And then can you ever go back? Once all your information has been put out there, can you ever go back to being a private person who is not in the public eye?
So basically, the Chronicle's defense was that it was protected speech to out this person's sexuality?
Absolutely. They said his character was at issue, which was an interesting way to put it. And they said that's something they get to write about under the First Amendment. Wow. And they won. They won the case.
That's interesting. Well, that makes me want to ask John, what do you think is the most... Well, since, I mean, and full disclosure, I write for Flashbot as well. So I participate in the culture there.
And the Chronicle.
And I write for the Chronicle too. I'm freelance. But since we often see a lot of interesting situations where people's privacy and sexual anonymity can be compromised, might be compromised, et cetera, what do you think is the most common, basic, stupid mistake that people make with their online sexual identity, just in general?
Okay, I guess in a nutshell, and this is what I've been telling people, I have a lot of friends who wanted to be here today and couldn't because they wanted to go see the I Can't Has Cheeseburger panel instead.
Mm-hmm. But we had some heavy competition.
Yeah, my take on this whole matter basically is that there is no sexual privacy online. That whole notion that that you have the right to complete privacy in certain things is an illusion. And I'll explain what I mean by that, because I realize that sounds like a pretty general blanket statement. As Violet said before, we're at the, you know, beginning of exploring this medium. I mean, the internet culture is barely in its second decade. And in the sort of flush of being able to express ourselves and to investigate our sexuality, we're forgetting that the rent that we pay on that is the risk of basically being found out. I came across a great quote by Oscar Wilde, actually, which sort of expresses that if one tells the truth, one is sure sooner or later to be found out. And it's something that everyone should keep in mind when they're doing things like uploading potentially compromising photographs or videotapes of themselves online. You basically have to do something like that with, no illusions that that's, you know, no matter how much it's password protected, no matter how much you trust that boyfriend or girlfriend is never going to let that off his hard drive or her hard drive. That again, sooner or later, by virtue of the way the internet works, you run the risk of having that, exposed. And, there's really, no way around that. Which isn't to say that we all can't also deserve, the right, what Jason was talking about, the right to be left alone. So those are two aspects that, that often come into conflict, with each other. The fact that we don't really have any sexual privacy, but that we do have the right to be left alone. And that's sort of a dividing line that I find myself and my writers on Fleshbot negotiating on a pretty regular basis.
On a daily basis.
Yeah.
Yeah. So you think that the most common mistake then that people make is just assuming that.
Right. And the best way to talk about this would be by example. I was, we were talking about, this happened a couple of weeks ago. There was a, there ought to be a word for this, but
we'll make one up.
There's not. Well, I mean, I want to say a sexual celebutante, I guess, let's say, on a site called XTube, which maybe one or two of you might have visited at some point.
Or heard of from a friend.
Or heard of, exactly, from a friend. I'm not going to say his screen name or anything like that. Although I will say, if you search on Fleshbot with some of the things I'm saying, you could easily find this person. He had uploaded several videos of himself onto the site called XTube. It sort of made the gay sex blog rounds and, you know, was sort of building up a little reputation for himself. Someone sent us a tip about, you know, his user profile on his videos, and we posted about it on Fleshbot. In all of these videos, not only did, and Violet can vouch because, you know, just on a purely professional collegial basis, I showed them to Violet.
But so of course, about this. Yes.
He made absolutely no effort to conceal his identity. I mean, all the videos sort of started with him
waving hi,
waving hello, and sort of shooting himself in the mirror and making it very, you know, this is me,
jacking off
the rest of me. And, so he had three or four, video clips on XTube. Not only did he upload, these video clips to XTube under a certain username, he also had a YouTube account under the same username with the same sort of geographical information. Obviously the material on XTube was just, you know, him playing with his dog. He started, some sort of vlog for a while, just talking about, I don't know, pop culture or something like that. But again, I mean, it didn't, you know, it was the same username. It was the same, you know, guy in both videos. Guess it was okay when he was on XTube.
How are you made aware of this,
about
his other identities
on,
or rather him using YouTube?
Because like I said, the his clips sort of made the gay porn blog rounds, and some blogger, you know,
that's the important part of the story for me is like,
right. Well, again, I mean, it wasn't he could have chosen a different screen name. He was being sort of naive about it, using the same, you know, it was maybe his nickname or something like that. But, you know, someone just, I guess, happened to do maybe a search for his XTube name to see if he had any things on other sites, maybe, and his YouTube profile.
He had a fan.
He had a fan, exactly. When we posted about him on Fleshbot, he got a lot more fans, I guess. And all of a sudden I started getting emails from this person claiming to be him, demanding that we take the post down because, you know, he never intended, for that many people. And that was sort of key. It wasn't that he, said he didn't intend anyone. He didn't intend for that many people to see his videos, and it was causing him all sorts of problems. Someone had, you know, contacted his parents and said, I mean, he was in college. He was, you know, completely of age and everything, but, someone had, had contacted his parents saying, you know, this is what your darling boy is doing in his dorm room, with his webcam. And, so again, you know, we sort of had to think, does he have a right to, you know, for us to take this material down? In this case, I had to decide that he didn't. First of all, because, he was sort of an asshole about it. If I could, you know, he was making all these threats and, you know, about it. But again, if you're, you know, if you're willing to go part of the way with something like this, again, you know, if you want to explore that side of your sexuality, there's different ways to cloak your identity to sort of make it more difficult, not impossible, but just more difficult for people to find out who you are. He didn't take any of those even basic preliminary steps. And I thought it would be a disservice to my readers and also the, you know, sort of the integrity of the site to take that post about him down. Now, we didn't post any of the videos. We have a comment filtering system on Fleshbot where commenters, you know, have to be approved. One of his fans out there, I don't know if I told you this part, one of his fans out there actually somehow found out this kid's actual name,
right,
and the school that he went to and everything. I did not approve that post because, again, that's where it sort of ran into the right to be left alone. And there was nothing for, you know, to be gained by anyone to know, you know, what small town this kid lived in and where he went to college and everything.
As far as removing the post too, there's a certain amount of blogger community awareness where once it's made the rounds,
right,
if we take it off of our site, how much difference does it make that it's still on other sites?
Yeah. And that's what I responded to his email. I'm like, you know, I understand where you're coming from, and, you know, we all you know, do something in a, you know, like in a, when we're drunk or I don't know.
Or sad or lonely.
Sad or something.
Or
but,
in love.
Well, A, he did it four times. So it's, you know, he must have been either sad or drunk or in love.
Let me ask, often. I'm curious though. So I definitely understand the piece of like his real name and address and right. all that. I mean, I think most people would think that from at least an ethical point of view, that that's also something to think really seriously about. What if this had not made the rounds in the gay blog? Post though, well, whatever. What if it had like 10 views and an anonymous person right. sent it to you and you could tell that it was some guy just messing around in his dorm room?
Yeah.
What goes in the calculation at that point?
Yeah. Well, I mean, I was going to bring that up as well, as far as, again, if you're making that step to, you know, take a video of yourself and upload it to a site like XTube, and you're, you know, again, you're making no attempt to hide, you know, you're waving at the camera, hi mom or whatever. Again, it's, you know, it goes back to that wild quote, yeah. if one's telling the truth, one is sure sooner or later to be found out. So in a case like that, I mean, I don't want to say you're asking for it, because I want to make it seem like a punitive thing. Like, you know, we're punishing you by,
well, it's also a case by case basis.
You should expect it though.
Well, you ought to expect it. And a certain part of the attraction or thrill or whatever you want to call it for people uploading material like that of themselves is the prospect of being found out. There's the great, case of the Walmart masturbator.
Yay!
I don't know. Has anyone heard about that?
It's an awesome video.
This, also, I want to know what other people talk, but this is also, I mean, I just said the words Walmart masturbator, so I sort of have to follow up with that. there was a case a couple of months ago where, actually, I should have one of my other colleagues tell the whole story, but I'll just sort of summarize. Where someone was uploading videos of themselves, again, to, you know, an XTube type site, of them doing what I just said, masturbating in large chain stores. You know, sort of what they would set up a camera on a shelf and sort of, you know, scoot down the aisle and drop their pants and go at it. And
you could see shoppers in the background.
Yeah, exactly. And again, but not only were they doing this in a very public space, but they were identifying, you know, I'm in the Albertsons on, you know, on Greenwood Road or something like that. So, and again, part of that particular fetish is the, you know, the prospect of being caught. One of our colleagues found these videos pretty early on, you know, before they really made the rounds. We posted something about it on Fleshbot. One of the other sites in the Gawker Media family also actually was consumerist, because obviously it's a consumer issue as
it
well.
It is a consumer issue. Yeah. Yes.
Low prices about it every day, well. Right?
clean up in aisle seven.
Via consumerist, it wound up on Dig, not on Fleshbot, because we can't post things on Dig, but that's
they
another,
don't let us.
That's but. Another panel. And via Dig, it got onto CNN and where else? It was okay. Yeah. So I mean, it really blew up. And again, because I guess he was wearing a certain university baseball cap or something. And, you know, he said the name of the mall that he was in where he was doing this. I mean, again, he made it fairly easy for people to do, you know, with 10 minutes, if that, on Google to find out who this guy was. And, you know, he was a 21-year-old community college student. You know, it got to the point, you know, where it was discussed on a number of sites, not just on Fleshbot, where I guess he started receiving death threats because of this, like, you know, this perv, you know, that could have been my mother shopping behind him.
Right.
You know, he should be. So, you know, were we ultimately responsible for, you know, ruining this guy's life or having him have to worry about, you know, some right-wing anti-sex, you know, gun nut, offing him next time he goes to a mall or something like that. I don't know. I mean, I'm just going
to,
you know, without sidestepping the question, but I'm going to, you know, I'm going to have to leave it there. But again, I mean, if he were that concerned about, you know, when you don't think through all the potential repercussions of doing something like that, you know, he started that ball rolling himself. We might have pushed it along a little bit, but, you know, so those are all things to think about.
Agreed. And what I want to pull into it is the more personal perspective that I think that Zoe brings into it, which is you aren't a sex worker, And you don't go jack off in Walmart and film yourself. Sorry, you were an anonymous
changing room one.
Oh, right.
It's in the book.
Oh, damn it. That's what I get. You simply wrote stories. You didn't put photos up or anything like that. It was your sexual adventures and it was anonymous. And what I want to know is, how did you get outed exactly? Do you know how or who or how your identity leaked out?
I don't think I'll ever know. I mean, I have suspicions, but I have no evidence, no.
Really?
No proof.
What happened when you were outed? Did the, you just opened your door and the press were there or?
My doorbell rang and someone said, there's a bunch of flowers for you. It's like the typical sting operation. It's what, you know,
seriously,
anyone would do. And I was like, oh, a bunch of flowers. It's, you know, la, 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 la. I opened the front door and there's someone there and they made me like lean out of the door and sign for them. I'm thinking, what am I having to lean? And then got the flowers in and there's a card on it and it said, congratulations on the book, because the book had been released that day.
Oh.
Well done, Zoe. And I was like, fuck. Somebody knows my name. I've written a book. Oh my God. Oh my God. Oh my God.
Oh wow.
And then I immediately thought, oh, okay, I've got a stalker or
right.
It's a newspaper.
Right.
And completely freaked. And what I didn't know was that while they were, the reason they made me lean out was because they had a photographer hidden in my garden with a long lens taking pictures of me.
So you were ambushed on your front step, essentially.
And I didn't know about the photos until the following day when they then started bombarding me with phone calls and emails and my home phone. And I had three mobiles at the time, three cell phones, and every single one was ringing. And I was just completely and utterly.
So that your number was given out, everything.
I'm ex-directory. I'm not on the electoral roll. I signed anonymity agreements, clauses, anything you can possibly imagine to maintain privacy.
Around the book.
Well, just generally in life. I've always, you know, been ex-directory because I just don't want, you know, junk mail and people knowing where I live.
Ex-directory means that you're not listed or something. I'm not
listed on any phone book or I have no idea how they managed to get
the
information.
That's crazy. So basically you sort of lived in hiding for a little while because it was a storm for you.
Then the tabloids descended as well.
Right.
So I immediately left my apartment and then all my neighbors were harassed by and my family as well by the newspapers who, you know, point their lenses through the letterbox and stuff like that. It was just.
And how did this affect the rest of your life in terms of like your day-to-day job and your friends and everything? Can you talk about that?
Yeah. Well, it fell apart, to put it simply. I lost my job. I'd been working for 10 years, building a career in the film industry. And I was told with no uncertain terms, you're no longer wanted in this career. Yeah. I think my name's been removed from the last film I worked on. My IMDb, my entry has been defaced. My personal information was posted up there actually with my phone numbers.
Oh, God.
You know, I was banned from the cast and crew screening of the movie that I worked on.
Really?
Yeah, banned by the producer. I probably shouldn't say that on a podcast. But I was, you know, like.
And all you did,
what?
All you did was
sex.
Write about sex.
Right.
Yeah.
And ironically, the lead of that movie was, it was Harry Potter 5. And, Daniel Radcliffe, the lead actor, performed on stage naked, right?
At
the same sort of time. And it's like the hypocrisy. Yeah. I'm a sex writer, sex blogger, and you can't have the two attached because, you know, it's a kid's film.
Right.
But yet he can be out there with
yet we're all adults.
Schlong in public. You know?
Right, exactly. Exactly. So what's changed for you since then in terms of how you blog? Now that people basically know who you are.
Well,
I'm not anonymous.
Yeah.
And I've never been anonymous. I've always used my real name. So I've had my own sets of ethical questions at every turning point with every, you know, piece of privacy or non-privacy that I share. So what's different for you now that you blog?
Well, if there's anyone who's ever read my blog here, you'll know that it's completely changed and it's no longer what it used to be.
How's that?
Well, I used to try and protect people's privacy and identities by disguising information. But
right.
I was absolutely 100% honest about the situations and the, you know, discussions that I got involved with, to the point where I've exposed my soul online. I really have, you know, emotionally as well as sort of sexually.
Right.
And when I got outed, it was like I just felt completely violated and exposed and naked in front of, you know, the world. And I was had my finger over that delete button, you know, hundreds of times. That
really?
Blog, I was just, it was going to go.
You're going to wipe it.
But in my heart, I'm a blogger. And it's like, you don't remove your stuff. You leave it there. And, you know, you've got links all over the internet and you've got to have that kind of integration with people. So I didn't. And I just wasn't able to continue writing in the same way that I once did, because I had the freedom of anonymity, right, where nobody knew who I was, nobody was judging me, mm-hmm, no one was making assumptions about me.
Right.
And now, of course, when I have intimate situations with people, you know, one of the first things they say is, you're not going to write about this, are you?
Right.
And, you know, even when I have a kind of beer with someone, they're like, you're not going to write about it. I mean, we're having a fucking drink, you know.
Yeah, right.
Give me a break.
Yeah.
So I don't. I don't even disguise it. I just don't write about people anymore. I don't feel like I can. I feel like it's exploitative of them. It invades their privacy, because by association and by the fact that if you Google me, there's hundreds and hundreds of pages,
sure,
they're linked with me, and I don't want their lives to be exposed. So mm-hmm, my blog now is kind of more what I'm up to rather than what I'm feeling and what I'm doing.
Right.
And I miss blogging so much. I can't
tell you. Feel like you don't, you feel like you're not a blogger anymore.
Yeah, yeah.
That's interesting.
And I've been tempted to set up another anonymous blog.
Yeah, right.
But now I know that you can be outed. It's like, well, what's the point, really?
So I had a question. Knowing all this, would you do it again, though? And if so, how would you change anything?
I'd lie to every single person that I met. I wouldn't tell anyone I was a blogger. I would disguise people much more thoroughly. And I wouldn't trust publishers, ever.
Probably a good lesson, yeah.
So, you know, I think it would be a good time for me to sort of interject everybody, is the fact is, you know, we've had a bunch of people say, like, you know, a lot of people do stupid things and that's how they get cut out. And you've almost said, like, you know, maybe I did something stupid. And the fact is, though, is largely it's what John said here is that it is actually basically impossible to keep your privacy in line. And there will be people who will tell you, you know, you can do this. And there are these technologies and they go by names like of Tor, and there's other kinds of anonymizing things, but they're really hard to use. And they limit you a lot, even in themselves. And it's so easy to screw up. There are so many ways. So basically, there are two categories of ways you can screw up, right? One is that you can do something stupid. And first, you have to know what stupid is.
Right.
And that's hard. And secondary, somebody you trust can do something stupid. And so in that case, it would be like, you know, so if you trusting people, so you use a social network, and social networks give you all of them give you some level of anonymity. And they see, here's what we'll expose and what they don't. But, you know, I can tell you that, you know, MySpace, I've found serious security holes more than once over the year of MySpace, you know, back when it first launched and as recent as this summer. I tell you, I know other large social networks, which I know currently have exploits against them, which allow you to steal somebody else's account, essentially log in as them and perform any actions of them. Security is really hard. So in some ways, it's not shocking that these people make these mistakes. And also, they're not coming from the standpoint of they think they're protecting everything. They're protecting like billions of dollars. But in the end, they really are protecting a lot of valuable things for their customers. But so that's how they can screw up for you. They can also screw up in that somebody can call and lie to them. There's a term that hackers use called social engineering, which is basically calling and lying and saying you're somebody else and getting the information you want. Like, you know, I call, like, oh my God, I've got this. Like, if to your ISP and say, I've got this really important like email and my computer just crashed and I don't have my password and I really need to get it. Can you reset my password to me? And blah, 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 blah. And it's not very hard to talk people out of, people in authority positions, especially, you know, low paid support people who have often the ones who have this access, into giving you what you want. So first you kind of can't trust other people. Your security is unlikely. You can't trust the people that are administering your software. You can't trust them from a implementation standpoint. You can't trust them from a business standpoint. If the government comes, they're almost certainly going to fold. If the government comes and gives somebody a subpoena and that company thinks the government has any valid right to give that subpoena, they're very likely going to turn it over, because you're one of, especially if it's a free service, like you're providing them, your value to them is like $30 a year, and them fighting it in court, unless they think it's a key business thing for them to fight it in court, they have no motivation to fight that in court. They're just going to turn over the information if they think the government has any validity in what they're doing. So those are, you can't trust people in those ways. And then as it turns out, it's really hard to even trust yourself. if you open yourself in an anonymous, okay, I'm going to be anonymous. I'm going to use an anonymous email address, but I'm going to open a Hotmail address, and then I'm going to send all my email through there. Nobody will be able to find me because they don't know who I am on Hotmail. The truth is every time you send an email from Hotmail, I don't know if you've ever gone into your mail client or thing, you say like view full headers or full message, and there's all this garbage at the top of the email. One of the things that's included in that with basically every webmail service is the IP address of the computer that you were at when you sent that email. And so the IP address is the essentially is the address of the computer. It's the machine readable form. So we have, just very quickly, you know, we have domain names. So when you type google.com, that's a domain name. And that's sort of a name. And in the same way, you could, like, if I wanted to send mail to Violet Blue here, I'm sending mail to Violet Blue, but I send it to her actual postal address. And sort of the IP address is like her postal address, and the domain like her name, Violet Blue. But the point is that address is tied to, at that particular moment in time, only one computer in most cases. And so every time you send an email, if you think you're sending it anonymously through a webmail account, it's very likely that email is there. And then, as I've had reason to do in the past, somebody has sent, I've acquired an IP address of somebody that was trying to maintain anonymity, but I was pretty sure they were somebody that I interacted with before. And I had all of their emails I've had all this set of emails that included the group of people that I likely considered it to be. And I could search through all of those emails and find who has emailed me using that IP address. And all of a sudden, this IP address, which actually in this case was an anonymous edit on Wikipedia, I now could tie to well, I've received three emails from this IP address, all from this one person. It's pretty certainly that person. So anonymity is really hard, and you're exposing information you don't know you're exposing. And then you can try and use these tools like Tor and stuff like that. But the problem is, as soon as you make one mistake, if you use Tor and you forget once to use it and you send that email once, you've now tied yourself to that piece of information and it's available. So, you know, there are people who will tell you you can be anonymous online, and technically it's likely possible, but it is so difficult to make it not practical for anybody. And to make it even possible, you have to be extremely technically competent and really understand all the tools you're using. There are just so many ways to mess up. And if I was trying to explicitly attack you, if you're using, say, Windows, there are usually at given times several known exploits where I could essentially infect your computer with a virus, you know, if I was explicitly trying to attack you, and I can send you an email that would infect your computer with a virus, you know, and back it off. I mean, that's sort of an active attack, and that's sort of different than most of the kinds you think. But the point that we're talking about here, but the point today is it's really, really hard.
So also, what I want to do is, you just sort of dovetailed into something that I kind of wanted to ask each person down the line here. And I want to kind of know from each of you, from your own perspectives, what you think the greatest challenge is, or what provides the most amount of risk for sexual privacy online. John, do you think it's just people themselves?
Well, again, I mean, you know, if you take it as a given that there's no such thing as sexual privacy, in a strange way, it makes things easier. Because, you know, you're not really expecting that this privacy is going to be maintained, and you could plan your actions accordingly. It's interesting that both Zoe and Jonathan talked about anonymity and the use of, say, you know, pseudonyms or ways to cloak your identity. One thing that we don't publish on Fleshbot is, adult performers' real names. For some reason, we get an awful lot of tips from readers saying, "Oh, you know, this girl who was in Dirt Pipe Milkshakes 47. You know, I went to high school," which actually it's not up to 47, but that is.
Of
a real
course, you look at me when you say that.
Yeah. We'll talk about Violet's fascination with me. You know, someone will say, "Oh, I went to high
I'm
school."
Responsible
with her,
for and, his awareness of the and, series. That's all we're saying.
Yeah, exactly. And her name is, you know, this, this, and this, and you know, she went to such and such a high school. And I think it would be really interesting for your readers to know who she is. Up until very recently, Wikipedia. If there were adult performers on Wikipedia, mm-hmm. You know, it would say born such and such a date. You know, real name in parentheses.
Right.
Yeah,
and it was people making anonymous edits,
right, yeah.
Or
and,
just edits.
To Wikipedia's credit, they've changed their policy. They will not publish real names of adult performers. People take, you know, these pseudonyms, noms de guerre, if you want to call it that, for a reason. Again, it doesn't make it impossible to find out who they really are and where they're from. But, you know, it's sort of one more measure of distance. And so I think that's where it comes to the, you know, to the right to be left alone. I think that's the point. And I think the greatest challenge that we're all facing is sort of establishing that wall, that boundary of the right to be left alone, because, you know, that boundary does exist. Even if you can't expect privacy all the time, you can still expect, you know, that you're going to be left alone at some point.
But, you know, the internet is sort of, I'm sorry,
it's
sort of mob rule in a way. I mean, just scroll through your average YouTube video comments and you can see the sort of base mentality. Obviously, everyone here sort of raises that discourse. But, you know, it's if you look at the great masses who make up, you know, a large part of the internet, unfortunately, they're the people who, you know, who we're up against and sort of maintaining that wall. So
thinking about that and thinking about that, I mean, in terms of challenges to privacy and thinking about what you've gone through, Zoe, and having gone through something which is completely out of your control that you still don't even know exactly what happened, what type of advice would you give to someone who wanted to have an anonymous sex blog?
Expect to lose your anonymity.
Really?
Absolutely.
Straight up.
Straight on. Don't ever think.
Don't ever expect it.
You know, prepare for the worst and hope for the best.
Really?
So, you know, the whole thing about emails, you know, being anonymous. I know Belle de Jour, the sex blogger who is still anonymous, always goes to internet cafes to send emails.
Okay.
It's that kind of thing. I wasn't as cautious as that, but I was a bit naive and thought, oh, well, yeah, I'll be fine. I've been so careful all the way. But, you know,
right.
Yes, be as careful as you can, but expect to lose it.
Interesting.
Sadly.
Interesting. Jonathan, can you talk about the monk that you were telling me about earlier?
There's an interesting social network.
This is a different subject, but it ties into something that you and I just mentioned earlier about terms of use.
So there's an interesting thing it ties into what you should expect is sort of the cultural, and that's there is a social network called High Five, which is not very big in the US, but is arguably the fourth largest social network in the world, and is very big in Thailand. And why it's interesting is last week, there was a huge explosion in the Thai news because there was a Buddhist monk who flirted with and then met a girl through the High Five social network. And in their particular take on Buddhism, monks apparently are not even technically supposed to talk with a woman without another monk present. So it was a huge problem that this person did. And monks are regarded very, very highly and given very high status in Thai culture. And in response, the Thai culture expects them to behave as they expect them to behave. They're fairly strict about how they behave. So this actually resulted in the Thai press calling for High Five to be banned from Thailand, and what are they doing in our country, and all this kind of stuff. And what it really comes to is you know, so should High Five choose to cooperate with the Thailand and, you know, shut down accounts of monks who seem to be behaving inappropriately or whatever like that. Like, is that wrong? It to me is fundamentally different than what we think about when we talk about, you know, oppression in China and things like that, where there's a small totalitarian group which is saying this is how all society should behave. And at least there's large portions of society that vehemently disagree, as seen in Tiananmen Square and like this. This is a case where there's where society was upset about this monk's behavior, not the government.
Right. It wasn't a legal issue.
It was a cultural issue.
Right.
And it's clear that apparently monks in Thailand have no sexual anonymity, and that's a cultural thing. And it's, you know, so how does that play into all of it? And how does that play into technology and businesses and what they should expose and what they should do?
So what does High Five do?
I don't think I can speak on exactly what their policy is about it. And I don't know if they've said anything publicly.
Okay.
But, you know, the idea that they could just, you know, if they cooperate with the Thai government with requests around those things, is that an unreasonable thing for them to do?
And the interesting flip side to that, too, is then, so, you know, what if a priest on Facebook?
Yeah.
You know, and that it, to try and translate it to our culture.
Yeah. I mean, it could be anything. What if it was a priest in the Onion comments?
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I don't know.
Right. Exactly. Exactly. Jason, did you have any?
Somebody wants a question right there.
Oh.
Do you want to use the microphone maybe? If it's going to be a little bit, well, you know, just run really quick or something. Because I think we're almost out of time, actually.
30 seconds left.
Your question.
So
be really
many of the panels have been talking about community management and what you need to do in social design to build social websites and social communities that behave well. And one of the things that they've been pointing out is that transparency and identity lead to healthy communities on these sites, but identity and anonymity seem to be at war there in this. So how do you see this idea of trying to stay anonymous, trying to stay private in your sexual identity, but wanting to use a social, because sex is social usually. How do you see those two playing off against each other?
Well, yeah. I'd like to just comment that on a sort of personal level, because when I started writing my blog, I wanted to write it under my real name, and I wanted to do everything completely honestly and openly and embrace, you know, the sort of the all sides of my life. But I live in a country in England, right, that judges women who are sexually active, you know, and judges women who talk about sex, and, you know, we're labeled and we're put down for it. And I knew, as has been proven, that if my real identity was known, that I would be judged harshly for that, you know. And I've lost my job, and I've lost, you know, friends out of it, and I've been thrown through the newspapers for many, many months afterwards. And it's been really, really tough personally, taking, you know, if you Google me, you come up with horrific shit about me, to be quite honest. And some of it's really, really fucking hurtful,
and a lot of it's not true as well.
Yeah, a lot of it's not true, but it's really painful in the personal way, and I've had to just get a thick skin about it and not care. But, you know, we live in a time when it would be wonderful to embrace, you know, being open and being sexual with the whole sort of, you know, online community and everyone having this big love in. But that's not the reality, unfortunately. So there is that need for anonymity. And if you want openness and honesty, I think we have to protect and uphold other people's anonymity. And I absolutely, you know, stand for anyone's right to be anonymous, even if it doesn't last.
I personally think it's platform solvable, though, as well.
Yeah, I mean, I think the technical answer to that is there's a concept that cryptographers and privacy people call pseudonymity, which is where you have an identity, it's just not tied to who you really are online. So you can build identity-based cultures where you build up identity. I mean, the fundamental, the unit of trust and how we all work in society, if you decompose it all, is experience. So if you have an account that nobody else can acquire and it's uniquely identified as you, you have you can have pseudonymity there, and you can build up trust and identity in that standpoint and use those kind of things people have been talking about.
Or it's tied to a part of you. And again, adult performers using, a pseudonym to perform, you know, that pseudonym is tied to a part of themselves, the performing part of themselves. It's obviously an extremely intimate part of themselves, but it's not all of themselves. So, I think the pseudonymity concept is a good thing to keep in mind with all of this. So does Lux?
Yeah. Oh, I just, first of all, I think this was a great panel. And I think that just the privacy things are things that go across the board and across like every aspect of our life.
Oh, but beyond sexual identity.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. But of course, there's a reason why this was a sexual privacy talk. And I think that one of the things that especially has been brought up by Zoe, and the larger issue that I see, because like, as John said, I don't believe that necessarily the big solution is expecting corporations to honor our privacy, because I think we all know we can't trust corporations. For me, the bigger issue is that the reason this is such a problem is because we have this shame around sex and sexuality.
Agreed.
And the fact that that someone can't work on a film because they have a sex life, because it's a children's film, and God knows people who work on children's films don't fuck. Absolutely, they don't.
You'd be so shocked to discover everyone was at it there.
Yeah,
and who knows? I was the good one.
Yeah, exactly, exactly. And don't fuck, I mean, I think it's just something that I think is really important to keep in mind, that I think we all have a right to privacy, but the problem with couching things in privacy from time to time is that it kind of connotes a shame.
Yes.
And it's like when we talk about, I have a right to get birth control because nobody needs to know about what I do, that's kind of suggesting that there's something wrong or something shame-based about me using birth control. And that's just a point I wanted to bring up, because
it absolutely goes back to my original point about how the internet is changing sexuality culturally for us permanently. Because I think that if we were in a less sexually shame-based culture, like the Craigslist experiment, that kind of shit wouldn't really even be happening, you know, because people would be less ashamed of their sexuality, or they would simply know how to cloak it better because they would be more in touch with what they were doing and who they were, and they wouldn't be hiding it. So yeah. And for some, it wouldn't matter at all.
I mean, just real quick on that, there are some people who do think that eventually with so many more people putting so much more personal information online, that will get like the tide will rise a little. So, you know, like the fact that you got drunk in college now, not such a big deal, even if your employer finds out, because later they may be like, oh, everyone does that, right? Or that you smoked pot at some point. A lot of people now in some places don't care about that. So it might be at some point that the tide rises and certain acknowledgement of sexuality might also not be as big an issue.
So everyone should run home after this and upload a video of themselves to XTube.
And send it to us.
I am, it's a sort of we'll I am Spartacus star. Approach to sexual privacy.
Yes, please. Because I have a badge fetish.
Well, hold it up.
Sweet. You have a question?
Yeah. Well, comment question. Yeah. I actually, my name is Jennifer and I actually do work for the big corporate corp and works with kids and all those people who actually I work for Disney. So okay. We definitely don't have sex.
No.
In any of our movies. But I have a lot of comments, but in particular, I work in the MMO space. So we have a lot of adults and children in our products. And of course, this isn't really around about children, but more about adult to adult conversation that I'm dealing with on a day-to-day basis. And mm-hmm. like, how do we, not how do we, but I mean, I know we're all sort of preaching to the choir. We all know that people don't understand that, you know, everything's you're never going to be anonymous online, but how do we get that out to the people who are coming to say a product like my own, thinking everything's safe, everything's wonderful, you know, and then they're going off and having sex in say the prison cells in one of my products. So,
right.
You know what I mean? So I guess that's, I don't know if it's a question or a thought to think about, like, what are our next steps? What is it that we can do to kind of say, hey, folks, other than just like PSAs on television, like, mm-hmm. you know, that are going to scare everyone, but how can we sort of really bring everyone to the forefront and everyone suddenly realizes, well, duh, if I put it online, you know, anybody in the whole world can see it.
I think it's just a cultural growth we need to go through. As John pointed out, we're in not even really the second decade of the internet as a national phenomena and a world phenomena. And it's all really new to us. You know, I'm sure people did really stupid things with cars at first when they became big, you know, probably a lot of drunk driving when cars first came out, you know, and we've kind of learned our lesson since then. And
Kind of, yeah.
But there's probably going
to
be
then that, like, you know, we're not learning.
We'd like to accelerate it, but we'd like to accelerate it. But at the end, we have to accept that there's a certain pace that society can evolve, and I think we're going to be stuck at that pace.
So we're no longer like learning at a faster pace either, is what you're saying.
Well, I think
we probably are. Maybe it's only going to take 20 years instead of 70. Yeah.
But I think you raise a good point about how you approach that kind of education, and this is actually one of the things that I think goes along with the shaming of sex, which is that. We do a lot of stuff on what we call internet safety. And that, in fact, even includes sort of like kids avoid the pedophile who's in the room, right? Mm-hmm. But I think we teach
which
people
actually,
about.
They're really good at.
Yeah, exactly.
They actually know how to
the
do that already.
But I think it's about, you know, we teach people about spam and viruses and a lot of other things. But if corporations are really willing to take this seriously, you need to take the same approach and include that as part of internet safety, which is there's a safety factor involved with your identity and exposure to your own personal life.
Thanks.
I just want to address the idea of not knowing when you're doing something stupid. And also with the idea of fighting shame. I have personally have been on camera and done things sexually and did so very much as a state of a statement of I'm not ashamed of any of this thing. And
I've blogged about you.
And then years later have had to deal with some pretty serious consequences as people tried to tie me to my family and my parents' careers and things like that. And so, you know, it's one of those things where the culture isn't yet to a point where your crusade is going to have consequences.
I agree. And one of the things that I say and say again, especially as someone who is a non-anonymous sex blogger, is that there is no map for what a lot of us are doing, especially those of us who are saying, you know, we're here, we're queer, we're having sex, we're, you know, and negotiating all of the difficulties, not just with dealing with the outside world and how the outside world judges us, but with all of our interpersonal relationships, even down to, you know, asking a friend if I can use their name on my sex blog in a non-sexual context because I have a highly ranked blog and I know that a search will lead back to their name. And sometimes the answer is no. And it does hurt my feelings because I believe so strongly in what I do, but I do respect that and I do always ask. And that's just something I've had to sort of figure out the hard way, along with, you know, asking lovers, are you okay with me blogging about this experience we had? And if so, in what ways? And it's like, you know, it's almost like a BDSM negotiation routine at a certain point where it's like, do you want a pseudonym? Are photographs okay? Neck to waist, you know, like, I mean, it's just, you know, you really, it's, like I said, there's no map. And I think that, you know, it's as individuated as sexuality is for every single person. But at the same time, I think that, you know, we're also evolving a certain set of standards as well as to what's, you know, what keeps us private and what doesn't keep us private. And I understand. You have a question?
Yeah, definitely. I think we're all finding out what our standards are and our behaviors are around this. When we're talking about the crusading, we all know from the history of sort of civil rights actions and so forth, you actually do have to take risk to get change.
Yes.
And it's how much risk we can each bear, mm-hmm. And how much risk we realize we're stepping into when we take our different actions.
Absolutely.
I completely understand about we're never, ever anonymous, no matter how much we try. I'm wondering about where there's hope in this. Like, we've been talking about the very difficult aspects, but I'm also wondering about the communities that we can tap into mm-hmm. around how we find support when we are exposed and we are having to deal with the blowback from people who've taken us out of context or whatever. So I was wanting some advice for you guys. From you guys about community and support there.
I want to answer that, but I want Zoe to answer that first.
Well, interestingly, amazingly, I should say, when I got outed, it was like the world came to hug me. The world of bloggers came to hug me. And in fact, if you...
Bloggers stick together.
Exactly. But yeah. I mean, I've always been part of the blogging community, but when I got outed, I had no idea how huge and vast this and supportive this community was.
Right.
And in fact, if you Google the name of the journalist who sent my mum bloody threatening email saying, you know, we're going to name you, which they wanted to, and where she lived and what she did for a living. My mother has nothing to do with my writing. If you Google his name, he was Google bombed by the whole blogging community.
Yeah.
And his name, actually, I think the second search on Google is, you know, oh, I don't know if I should say his name, but
you can just say so-and-so
is a cunt, which is just, I love it. It gives me so much pleasure knowing that it's 18 months on.
Right.
And if you search for him or you search for the other journalists who wrote the piece, mm-hmm. they are still, their Google juice is fucked, basically.
Right.
Because bloggers
because
came around
and said, like a douchebag.
Exactly. This yeah. is out of order. You don't do this to one of ours.
Right.
And it proved that the community was out there and was supportive, which to me is the interesting story. It's not about me being outed or losing my sexual privacy. It's about the fact that suddenly hundreds of thousands of people around the world are saying, no, this does not go on.
This is not,
you know,
okay.
We are the power and not old media.
Exactly. Exactly. And in a sense, we are the media then after that point.
And society is changing its rules.
Yep.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I think also, I mean, some of the silver lining out of this too is that, and this is something that I talked about a little bit in my eTech talk, which is that part of the price that I have paid, especially now that I write for mainstream media, is that now I do have stalkers, which I didn't really have before. I have had 3 death threats. I am targeted on a number of sites. My Wikipedia, the Wikipedia article about me has been vandalized more times than the mayor of San Francisco, which was pointed out to me by my editor in the San Francisco Chronicle. But at the same time,
and remember, the mayor of San Francisco tried to legalize gay marriage.
That's true. But the thing is, at the same time, by putting myself out there and being on my blog and being vulnerable and being sexual and being who I am, fucking up, making mistakes, admitting it, getting hurt, you know, losing lovers, basically having people break up with me online. I mean, just going through all of it and being open and transparent has made me much more a point of access, because it's made me so much more human. And it's so much different than, you know, here's the sex educator on the pedestal on the other side of the wall, or, you know, here's the, you know, Sex in the City illusion of the girl leading the glamorous life, or any of that. It's just, here's this human being who's just going through these experiences and, you know, trying to be an educator at the same time. And it's made it more human and more real. And so I get much more direct contact with all of my readers. I get emails from people who thank me on a daily basis for, thank you for this resource. I really needed it. You know, am I gay? Where do I go to find out? You know, like, I have a complete resource page for kids who are under 18 who come to my site. So when you click on that, I'm not old enough to get in here, you're kicked to this other resource page that gives accurate sex information for teens. And, you know, I get emails all the time from people who are like, you know, you recommended this book and, oh my God, it helped me. It saved me. And I think that's, It's like one person at a time, but it's a huge point of change, I think, for us.
I think it's all tied into what Lux was saying about removing the shame or stigma that's attached to sex. I mean, what Violet's doing, I like to think of what we're all doing to, you know, one extent or another is trying to alleviate that stigma that's attached to talking and thinking about sex and looking at sex and whatever. And I think as far as building communities that can address that, if we all try to, further that dialogue about sex and make it something that, that's not stigmatized. And I know that sounds all, whatever, but I mean, we have come a long way, and the internet, much of a sort of wild and uncontrolled place it could be, I think is ideally suited to building those kind of communities that can, make being associated with sex not such a bad thing.
I just want to throw in one last thing from my perspective, which is that other privacy issues have come up in communities, like with Facebook Beacon and some of these other issues, and communities have rallied. They started groups, they get mm-hmm. going, they support each other to get the companies to change the policies. And I don't think sex should be any different. So I think thinking about it as a general privacy movement can also help.
Yeah, well, it's risk assessment, which is something that we talk about in Safer Sex, which is, it's called safer because it's not 100% safe. It's being able to make an assessment of the risk that you're taking at any given time and being able to take precautions against whatever you don't want to get. And then also the new wave of sex education around safer sex, which is sort of my generation's more controversial approach, which is harm reduction, which is basically letting people know what the risks are around what they're doing and allowing them, giving them the tools to make those choices, to reduce the harm, essentially. So, yes.
Well, I've been given a reminder, and I've been forced by South by Southwest to do something as an English person I'm really uncomfortable doing, which is to say, I'm doing a book signing tomorrow at 3:45 at the South by bookstore. Self-promotion over.
It's cool.
And that ties into furthering the dialogue about sex. So that's how it
kind of.
Indeed.
Well done.
All right. I think we're out of time. Is that right? Yes, she's a guest. Thank you.